To complete the neutron interferometry, though, I won't actually have to talk at all about neutrons today to do that. But let's review a little bit. So with neutron interferometry, you know, we've used it as a sort of easy to visualize, easy to get our arms around example of a quantum system. And of course, we've seen coherence and measurement just in the form of a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. And because we can add spin, we could look at entanglement, we could see the importance of entanglement, the robustness. We could show that if we rotated either of the individual qubits that make up an entangled state, that the entanglement is preserved, and that if we lost coherence on either, the entanglement is lost. We looked at incoherence. Maybe that's a hard thing to get across, right? That incoherence, we have a distribution over some expectation value measurement of some random process, but it's inherently recoverable. And a good example for incoherence is the phase loss due to a prism that we would put in one arm of the interferometer. And of course, we could put a similar prism in the other arm of the interferometer, or you could put the inverse prism following the prism. Either way, we would recover contrast. So there's a correlation that we've set up by putting that prism. The correlation really trivially is the phase and location of the neutron beam, and we can use that information to recover. Decoherence is in the neutron interferometry is a really similar effect, because now you've lost the phase information, but in some way which is not recoverable. And so the easiest piece for me is the random variation of the width of the blade. So it's just surface imperfections on the blade. And since they're random, although they're reproducible, we can't reproducibly put the neutron back there. But of course, we could also think about it in terms of spin. If I have the spin degree of freedom and I have a random magnetic field, then that's going to lead to a loss. The T1 effects we haven't talked about, and they're pretty much absent, I think, in terms of a neutron interferometer, because we've post-selected on those neutrons we observe. And so by post-selecting, we don't have this ability to say, I've lost neutrons. And of course, we looked at wave and particle duality by shifting the beam with a pair of prisms. We could shift the beam relative to its interfering path. So we could shift one path relative to the other, and we could directly map out the wave packet of the system. So now I want to do something a little bit different. I still want to talk about statistics. I want to talk about the variance of a measurement and show you how we can squeeze that. So I can take and look at two different observables, and I can make the variance in one observable smaller than the variance in the other observable. Okay. And if you want to squeeze, you need some nonlinear operator. And there's a rich literature on a variety of nonlinear operators. But it tells you right away that you're not going to squeeze a spin 1/2 particle. Because if I take the square of any poly, of course, it squares to the identity. So unfortunately, there are no nonlinear operators hanging around in a single spin 1/2 space. And so we need to go someplace a little bit more complicated. And the simplest place to go is a spin 1. And if I think about spin one, then I'm going to have three basis vectors, which are the projections of the Z magnetization for a spin one particle. Spin one, not spin identity. And JZ, therefore, has this nice diagonal form. And of course, JZ squared then is not the identity. And so we can squeeze based on JZ squared. But I want to apply, actually I want you to apply, I'm not going to do it, but I want to apply these ideas to neutron interferometer. We don't have a spin one in the neutron interferometer. So instead of pretending that we can have a spin one, what we're going to do is we're going to look at the spin one subspace of two spin one half particles. And that's easy enough. You've probably seen this at some point in your quantum mechanics course, that if you take two particles and you have a strong exchange interaction between them, then that exchange interaction removes any difference between the particles. You end up falling into the triplet and singlet manifolds. And so you go from a case where you have a Zeeman interaction, you have the eigenstates, and if I have exchange, then I would end up in the eigenstates. Like so. And of course, the top three are symmetric. And so these are the three that we're going to map. Into the spin that we want, okay? And of course, the singlet state hangs out there, but we'll arrange our experiment so that we never access the singlet state, okay? Good.
Sorry, so by non-linear, you mean that it doesn't, or it squares to something else than identity?
Well, you know, if you go, no, remember that, I don't mean that. So remember that the idea that the polys square to the identity is just the polys, right? If I take the spin operators in spin one, of course, they don't square to the identity. So what I mean by nonlinear is that I've applied the square of an operator. Okay? And we could connect it to nonlinear in this sense of saying that one of the ways you get nonlinearity in quantum mechanics, you know, quantum mechanics is linear, right? Pound the table. Quantum mechanics is linear. Good. But if I look at a subspace, then the apparent dynamics in a subspace need not be linear, right? So you can parse it a few ways, but let's just take it that we're applying the square of an operator, and we'll just work it out in gory detail, and we'll see that the variance changes. And let's look pictorially for a second. So if I have a spin one half particle, then we know that the uncertainty principle leaves us sitting on a cone. And if I was going to squeeze a particle, well, I certainly want that we're going to be not aligned with it. So I take my cone, I'll put it along the x-axis. And now I have to tell you that this is a cone in spin one space. Okay, so it doesn't quite look like that, but it's the best I can do. And it's with the pictures that, you normally see. And then we apply this operator. And what this operator does is it ends up creating a state which is a squeezed version of this cone. It shears the cone. And by shearing that cone, it changes the variance over the two directions, okay? And it's easier to write up a Mathematica notebook and see this for yourself, but you'll also see it, of course, in many, many pictures, in many publications. But let's just go and write down the experiment. Actually, I'm gonna put that here. So the experiment we're going to do, I'm going to give you the experiment, analyze it, and then we'll motivate it. I'm going to start with two spin one half particles. I'm going to start with them in their eigenstates. I'm going to apply Hadamard to each. And then we're going to apply this squeezing operator. I want to look at this in both the two spin one half space, because the two spin one half space is where we're going to do the experiment. I want to look at it in the spin one space. All right. So the initial state is the two spins being polarized . My convenience, I dropped the identities that these are tensored with. And of course, this is an identity over the full 2-qubit space. And these are identities over the 1-qubit space, right? But all that you can abstract out. Yeah? So now we have this piece into this. I got ahead of myself. That's the next step. To this, I'm going to give a 90 degree pulse about y, which is going to, for both spins, which is going to leave me to the state that I just wrote down. And then I'm going to apply this operator, sigma z, sigma z. I'm going to apply it for some angle, for some time. And you'll note a couple of nice things, that sigma x, that those commute. So this will be a constant of the motion. And of course, if I have sigma x the identity, and I apply an operator sigma z, then of course sigma z commutes with the identity. Sigma x and sigma z give you sigma y, so this is going to evolve into this correlated state of two spins. All right. So this is how this operator evolves under that operation, right? I'm not just writing out the matrix exponential. We sandwich it and multiply it.
What is theta?
Theta is the action of this. So if I was going to write down the Hamiltonian, I'd write it down as that. Okay, so in theta will turn out to be what's called in the literature the squeezing parameter. It'll be actually the squeezing parameter plus a half, I think, plus pi over 2, but it's close enough. Okay, so now then we can write down this state, so we'll have 1/4 and cosine of theta like so. Good. Now, I'm interested in what happens in the spin 1 space. The spin 1 space is going to be the one that we can squeeze in. Of course, here, you'll agree with me, I hope, that everything that this state lives in a fully symmetric manifold. In other words, if I swap the two spins, nothing happens. Okay? But still, we need to write down a set of operators for spin 1. And of course, we have a lot of choices of finding 9 operators. Spin 1, so we need 9 operators. But I want a set of operators that are going to be well connected to my two-spin system over there. And so the operators I'm going to choose to use are the total spin and when I write these down, you know, here what I've written down is I've written down the total spin in the two spin, two qubit case. Here I want it in the spin 1 case. And so I'm going to write down for you the matrix of Jx just spanned by the 3 operators that live in this fully symmetric space. And so Jx in that space is that, where I've just labeled it plus 1, 0, minus 1 for the rows and columns. And of course, maybe it's worthwhile to remind you that if I wrote it down, if I wrote it down over the two spins, right, that, you know, we would see these symmetries that are telling us this lives in the fully symmetric space. Yeah? And so it's this, you know, It's not, I take an equal superposition of those, rewrite it, and there's nothing left in the asymmetric space. Okay, so this is the total spin. And bloody hell, that is Jx, of course, right? Just not Jk, right? That was probably your question that I was...
Yeah,
you're correct to be confused. Okay, the next three operators are the square of these. So the total spin squared. And it's worthwhile to write these out. Now, as you'd expect, and of course, I've already given you the matrix up there, these things are going to square to the identity. So this will, and other than that, you're going to get twice sigma x. So we get twice the identity plus twice sigma k, sigma k. Okay. And if I wrote out Jx squared for you, it looks like that. Good. And there's, so we've got six of our operators, and the last three are the symmetric bilinear operators. JKL, which are sigma k, sigma l, plus sigma l, sigma k, on different spins, of course. And this, you'll agree, is equal to sigma L, to JLK. And so there's only three of these. And now we have a set of nine operators. And these sets of nine operators are orthogonal, they're complete, they form a group, they do everything we would like. So we can use them. And I'll write down JYZ because we'll end up using it. Which looks like that. And it's also I better put proportional. Check on that. It's certainly proportional, whether there's a minus sign there or something. Yeah, I let you. So now then we've got here a density matrix as a function of theta. And we can see that we can rewrite this immediately in terms of the operators that we have on the other side. So we have that rho theta is equal to 1/4 cosine of theta jx plus sine of theta jyz plus jx squared divided by 2. Okay, so now we're nicely in the spin one basis. And we have our experiments. All we need to do is to calculate the expectation values. So if we look at the expectation values of Jx, the total spin, which is, of course, equal to the trace of Jx rho of theta. And that's cosine theta. I told you they were orthogonal, so it's easy enough to see. It's worth remembering that if you want to measure this, you have to measure the sum of sigma x on both of the qubits, right? But if you do that, that's your expectation value. And it shouldn't surprise you that if you measured Jy or you measured Jz, that those are zero, of course. And if we look at Jyz as a function of theta, then this, of course, is equal to minus sine of theta. I think it must be that. Just because my notes say something doesn't mean it's true. You have this lovely tutorial to work out all the details, you'll be able to do that. And so if we plotted the expectation value versus theta, then we see that for Jx, Jyz, and Jx squared, we've got these three dependencies. But the whole point was to look at the variance of these. And so the expectation of the variance of Jx of theta is equal to the square root of the variance of the square minus the expectation value squared. And this piece is 1 by look at the trace of Jx squared here. Then we see it's 4, end up with 1 here. This, of course, we've already calculated. That's cosine theta. So the expectation, the variance of this function is equal to the square root of 1 minus cosine theta. Similarly, the variance, that would be good. The variance is equal to 1 minus sine squared theta. And so if we look at a plot of the variance versus theta, then we see plots like this. And this is the piece of it which is usually shown. To show that you can start with a state that has a variance which is equal in these two observables. And I can remove the variance from one of them at the cost of the variance in the other. Good.
So how do you actually make this?
Yeah, that's your tutorial.
It's like, are you going to have a hard time if you want to get two neutrons started at the same time?
Oh. No. Okay. You're going to make it, but without magic.
Okay.
So, we want to do this in neutrons. But what I want to do is I want to create a coherent superposition of the spin displaced. And then I want to squeeze that. Okay, I want to know, we've used this displaced spin. I put it way over here. We have our interferometer. With the prisms. And now I have this coherent superposition of the neutron being displaced and not displaced. And I want to know if I can squeeze this. And if I do squeeze it, what does it mean? And does it change the measurement that I could make when I scattered it off materials? Okay. Now, we have to be careful here. So the model is the one up there on the top board. It says, oh, apply two Hadamards, create this bilinear squeezing operator. And then, depending upon the strength at which you've applied this, change your state. And so now then, let's look here, because you're going to figure out this problem. But here's a nice place because, of course, we span many of the states. And so now we have a wave function which is path and displacement. And so what does this operator tell us that we want to do over the path and displacement degrees of freedom?
We want to pick the one where they're both like in the top path and top displacement. And all right, and the bottom path and bottom displacement. It's weird.
So it says I want to apply a conditional phase shift along Z of the path of the displacement degree of freedom conditioned on the path. It's always nice, I think, to remember that if we have sigma z, we can go back and we can write it in terms of the idempotence that I used but failed to define. Is that true? Well, I gave you one. But sigma z Thank you. I'll make it much nicer. And so now then you can say, oh yeah, so this thing goes into sigma z on the displacement e plus on the path minus sigma z displacement e minus on the path with some normalization. So that's what you want to do. It says, I want to apply a phase shift on the displacement in one path. I want to apply an opposite phase shift on the displacement in another path. And I cannot do that with one single prism. But if you give yourself a few prisms, and if you allow yourself the freedom to put them on either side of a blade, then you'll be able to do this. And this initial piece here, so certainly this is a Hadamard, right? But this piece is a controlled knot, right? It's not a Hadamard. Does that matter? So think about that, whether you really want to give a set of Hadamards. And of course, you can do that, right? By the time you get here, you could have given this whole thing could look like a set of Hadamards. But maybe you don't actually have to do that, right? That's just the easiest thing to analyze. And remember that we ended up here because of the initial correlations of the spins, even though they were classical. And it's usually, as I said, this piece that people think about when they're squeezing a parameter. So for your tutorial, I'd like you to do a few things. One, figure out how to, here I've taken you from two spin one halves to a spin one. It might have been more logical to you if I had taken you from a spin one to two spin one halves, but if you go one way, you can go the other. And now I want you to say, okay, I've got these two spin one half particles. Let me go and use them in the lab. And then the hardest part of this, but this is no great shakes. That's just pretty hard. But the next hardest part of it is to say, well, what does it mean? If I squeeze this parameter, what does the distribution actually look like? And if I took that displaced wave function and I scattered it off of a grating, would I see a difference? And fortunately, you have an expert in squeezing, so you're all going to be good. Now, don't let her get away with that, okay? Any questions on that? It's worth agonizing over a little bit before you show up for the tutorial. I'd probably make Aggie agonize. Yes?
So why do you call this squeezing?
So because it's called squeezing, and it isn't me, because you go from a state where the variance is equal in two observables to one where the variance is reduced and the other one becomes large. So it's as though I took that cone and I squished it down in one direction and forced it out in the other direction. So the typical pictures of squeezing says, oh, I just have this axial But in fact, it's almost always a shear that you apply to the cone instead of a squishing. Yeah? Okay, now then. Now that I've lost my piece of paper.
It's in the Bible, right?
Oh, thank goodness. Your homework was gone for a second there.
Damn it, Alex.
Now your homework is recovered. So for your homework, what I want to do is we're going to start tomorrow talking about general methods of taking, controlling, using qubits. And I want to give you a Hamiltonian, and I'll give you a choice of operations for you to take and manipulate that your qubits to achieve. So, the Hamiltonian comes in three pieces, and we're going to look at four qubits, because four qubits is already a drag to compute with. So we're going to have some Zeeman term, some energy corresponding to a spin flip, and some coupling, and the coupling is just nearest neighbor. Okay, so you can think about these in a line, and I suggest you think about them in a line. You could, of course, think about them in a ring, but I think it only makes your life a little bit more tricky. Yeah, but it's up to you. If you find something neat to do on a ring, you know, don't let me get in your way. Now then, there's noise, because we've agreed that we're not going to allow two simplified models. But I want to give you noise of a nice structure so that your weekend is somewhat preserved. So the noise is going to act on two qubits at a time, that these terms fluctuate, but they're slow. And so the way I want you to think about that is every time you go and address your system, this has some random value within a distribution. But during your experiment, it's constant. Okay? So it's very much like the incoherence part of things. Okay? So it's random. But over the length of time that you're going to run your experiment, it's constant. So if you try to measure an expectation value, you have to average over instances of that noise. And if you want to have a robust gate, then your gate must work regardless of the value of that noise parameter. That's what we would mean by robust.
Do we have like a range of frequencies?
You can choose what you like. Okay? So depending upon what piece, what problem you look at, it may make more sense or less sense. So I'm not too worried. Now, of course, remember that since I'm giving you noise, It's on. There are solutions that would cancel that noise out perfectly, regardless of its value. I'm not requiring this. So, you know, you may find that depending upon the width of that distribution, you can select only some subset, and that's perfectly fine, right? We don't require fidelity one. And then there's the control, which is a function of time. This, of course, is a function of time. So these two parameters are under your control. Those are the only two parameters under your control. So everything you want to do has to come by saying you have a set of events which is to vary those. We're going to make your life easier by saying that omega sub k is equal to omega t plus delta omega of k, and the delta omega of k divided by omega t is less than 10 to the minus 3. And the reason for that is so that the rotating wave approximation is a good approximation. And we'll talk about that tomorrow. But probably you've seen the rotating wave approximation in one of your courses already. We'll talk about it tomorrow.
Okay. Well, I was going to ask, so you're expecting us to implement some gate in this system?
That's the next board. So, here's some suggestions. Yeah, given the form of the noise, it's nice to think that you should be able to use logical qubits. And the logical qubits maybe only have noise which is along Z. So that's the noise you have to worry about correcting. You know, there's no other noise in the system. Okay? And I didn't say it up there, but I give you the right to put the qubits in the ground state, right? So I haven't given you any means to put the qubits in the ground state, but you have the right to do that by fiat. Since you have two logical qubits, then you can create a Bell state. Of course, you could create the logic gates over them. You could run a Deutsch-Jose algorithm. You could run an error detecting code.
Can you recover the full quantum computation from the control gate?
We have universality. Yeah. That's not bad. You can show that you have universality.
Delta omega k is a different.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Pointing out that delta omega k is different for each qubit.
Right, okay.
You could create.
Do we know? Oh yeah, how well do we know the properties?
You can choose everything except the noise as you like. You can create a four-spin GHZ state. If you do, you have two choices. One, you can see what happens with noise. Or two, you can say that you're going to refocus the noise. Here it's a little bit tricky, right? Because I told you that every time you have an instance of this noise, it's going to stay for the lifetime of your experiment. But if you created a four-spin GHZ state, so the state 0000 plus 1111, and you wanted to see how that noise influenced it, then I would let omega n vary in time over the state, because it's going to take you out of that state. And the other four-spin experiment is you can create a four-spin, a DFS for one qubit that's robust for collective noise along any axis. So the noise model isn't quite right for that, but you still have the controls to look at that if you wanted to.
What is DFS?
A decoherence free subspace. So it's a proper subspace where the noise doesn't act. It is, but you know, you don't even we don't need that you can use that language. You don't need that language. And since we've written the noise as being symmetric over pairs of qubits, then you know already we saw here that there was another part of the Hilbert space of a two spin, which is orthogonal to that.
So when you say robust for collective noise, you mean allowing like all my sigma z star to do whatever they want?
Yeah, so if I have a noise model which is...
Oh, that, okay, sure.
Right? So anything that's collective, you'll be robust too. And it takes four spins to create that for DFS. You can create the same sort of protection in a subsystem with three spins, but it's not a proper subspace, and so you need to worry about other operators. And if Daniel talked to you about it, then you understand. If not, it's a bit complicated, but we can spend a moment and talk about it.
So if we're doing DFS for one qubit, then we want to, so we're allowing noise being the collective sigma z modes you've set on like one or two, and this full collective mode in all the z's and all x's.
Yep.
And all the y's. Is there any, I mean, if I'm going to go, and you know, this looks like you can go, something you can go actually, made, you guys are actually going to made in the lab. I mean, why do you worry about the collective noise and not like a single sigma z?
If I said that the noise was Markovian and different for every spin, then I'm stuck with quantum error correction.
Right.
And so then the inefficiencies in building a computer become a drag, We still try to build a computer, you know, but if I want to give you something that you can control, right? If I said, oh, you need to code for every error over the spins, then 4 spins is not enough to do that.
You need 5.
You need 5 in a perfect code. So 5 if you don't allow errors in your code.
Right.
Okay.
How about measurements in this system?
You're free to make whatever measurement you want.
So this is like, I mean, this is some level of an ion trap, am I right?
You know, I could say it's an ion trap. I could say it was spins. I could say it was a flux qubit. I could describe it as a quantum dot.
Right. But with the way you've actually written out the interaction Hamiltonian.
Yeah, I could do any of this.
Okay.
So in general, these things tend to look pretty much the same. You know, there was a moment a decade ago where people thought you could have internal Hamiltonians that were zero. But unfortunately, you know, if you try to hit zero, then everything's important, right? Anything's big compared to zero. So it becomes a drag of a place to reach. So it's easier to say, oh, I'm going to do some action to suppress noise, and then I want some average action of the gate to look like the identity operator. And we'll see that too next few days. Okay, then I hope it's a fun and productive time at the tutorial, and there's the homework. Thanks.